Chapter 3. The Grand Inquisitor was late. Vatican Airspace Traffic Control routed the Inquisitor's EMV across normally closed airspace near the spaceport, shut down all airborne traffic on the east side of the Vatican, and held a 30,000-ton robot freighter in orbital final approach until after the GI's car had flown across the southeast corner of the landing grid. Inside the specially armored EMV, the Grand Inquisitor, His Eminence John Domenico Cardinal Mustafa, did not glance out the window or at the video monitors at the lovely sight of the approaching Vatican, its walls rosy in the morning light, or at the busy 20-lane highway called the Ponte Vittorio Emanuele beneath them, glimmering like a sunlit river because of sunlight on windshields and bubble tops. The Grand Inquisitor's attention was focused solely on the intelligence update, scrolling by on his comlog template. When the last paragraph had scrolled past and was committed to memory and deleted to oblivion, the Grand Inquisitor said to his aide, Father Farrell,
"And there have been no more meetings with the Mercantilis."
Father Farrell, a thin man with flat gray eyes, never smiled, but a twitch of his cheek muscle conveyed the simulation of humor to the Cardinal. "None."
"You're certain?"
"Absolutely." The Grand Inquisitor sat back in the EMV's cushions and allowed himself a brief smile. The Mercantilis had made only that one early, disastrous approach to any of the papal candidates, the sounding out of Lourdesami, and the Inquisitor had heard the complete recording of that meeting. The Cardinal allowed himself another few seconds of smile. Lourdesami had been right to think that his conference room was bug-proof, absolutely resistant to taps, bugs, wires, and squirts. Any recording device in the room, even implanted in one of the participants, would have been detected and homed in on. Any attempt to tight-beam out would have been detected and blocked. It had been one of the Grand Inquisitor's finest moments, getting the complete visual and auditory recording of that meeting. Monsignor Lucas Oddi had gone into the Vatican Hospital for a routine eyes, ears, and heart replacement 2 local years ago. The surgeon had been approached by Father Farrell, and the full weight of the Holy Office had been shown ready to descend upon the poor medico's neck if he did not implant certain state-of-the-art devices in the Monsignor's body. The surgeon did so and died the true death, no resurrection possible, in a car accident far out over the Big North Shallow shortly after that. Monsignor Lucas Oddi had no electronic or mechanical bugs in his system, but connected to his optic nerve were 7 fully biological nanorecorders. 4 auditory nanorecorders were tapped into his auditory nerve system. These biorecorders did not transmit inside the body, but stored the data in chemical form and physically carried it through the bloodstream to the squirt transmitter, also fully organic, set into Monsignor Oddi's left ventricle. 10 minutes after Oddi had left the secured area of Cardinal Lourdesami's office, the transmitter had squirted a compressed record of the meeting to one of the Grand Inquisitor's nearby relay transponders. It was not real-time eavesdropping from Lourdesami's bug-proof rooms, a fact that still worried Cardinal Mustafa, but it was as close to it as current technology and stealth could get.
"Isozaki is frightened," said Father Farrell. "He thinks..."
The Grand Inquisitor raised one finger. Farrell stopped in mid-sentence.
"You do not know that he is frightened," said the Cardinal. "You do not know what he thinks. You can only know what he says and does, and infer his thoughts and reactions from that. Never make unsupportable assumptions about your enemies, Martin. It can be a fatal self-indulgence."
Father Farrell bowed his head in agreement and submission. The EMV touched down on the landing pad atop Castel Sant'Angelo. The Grand Inquisitor was out the hatch and down the ramp so quickly that Farrell had to trot to catch up to his master. Security commandos, dressed in Holy Office red armor cloth, fell into escort step ahead and behind, but the Grand Inquisitor waved them away. He wanted to finish his conversation with Father Farrell. He touched his aide's left arm, not out of affection, but to close the bone conduction circuits so that he could sub-vocalize, and said,
"Isozaki and the mercantilist leaders are not frightened. If Lord Usami wanted them purged, they would be dead by now."
Isozaki had to get his message of support to the Cardinal, and he did. "It's the Pax military who are frightened." Farrell frowned and sub-vocalized on the bone circuit. "The military? But they haven't played their card yet. They have done nothing disloyal."
"Precisely," said the Grand Inquisitor. "The mercantilist has made its move and knows that Lord Usami will turn to them when the time comes. Pax Fleet and the rest have been terrified for years that they'll make the wrong choice. Now they're terrified that they've waited too long."
Farrell nodded. They had taken a drop shaft deep into the stone bowels of Castel Sant'Angelo, and now they moved past armed guards and through lethal force fields down a dark corridor. At an unmarked door, two red-garbed commandos stood at attention, energy rifles raised.
"Leave us," said the Grand Inquisitor, and palmed the door's ID plate. The steel panel slid up and out of sight.
The corridor had been stone and shadows. Inside the room, everything was bright light, instruments, and sterile surfaces. Technicians looked up as the Grand Inquisitor and Farrell entered. One wall of the room was taken up by square doors, looking like nothing so much as the multi-tiered human file drawers of an ancient morgue. One of those doors was open, and a naked man lay on a gurney that had been pulled from the cold storage drawer there. The Grand Inquisitor and Farrell stopped on either side of the gurney.
"He is reviving well," said the technician who stood at the console. "We're holding him just beneath the surface. We can bring him up in seconds."
Father Farrell said. "How long was his last cold sleep?"
16 local months," said the technician. 13 and a half standard."
"Bring him up," said the Grand Inquisitor.
The man's eyelids began to flutter within seconds. He was a small man, muscular but compact, and there were no marks or bruises on his body. His wrists and ankles were bound by sticktite. A cortical shunt had been implanted just behind his left ear, and an almost invisible bundle of microfibers ran from it to the console. The man on the gurney moaned.
"Corporal Basenki," said the Grand Inquisitor, "can you hear me?"
Corporal Key made an unintelligible sound. The Grand Inquisitor nodded, as if satisfied.
"Corporal Key," he said pleasantly, conversationally, "shall we pick up where we left off?"
"How long,"
mumbled Key between dry, stiff lips,
"how long have I been?"
Father Farrell had moved to the technician's console. Now he nodded to the Grand Inquisitor. Ignoring the corporal's question, John Domenico Cardinal Mustafa said softly,
"Why did you and Father Captain de Soya let the girl go?"
Corporal Key had opened his eyes, blinking as if the light pained him, but now he closed them again. He did not speak. The Grand Inquisitor nodded to his aide. Father Farrell's hand passed over icons on the console disk key, but did not yet activate any of them.
"Once again," said the Grand Inquisitor, "why did you and De Soya allow the girl and her criminal allies to escape on God's Grove? Who were you working for? What was your motivation?"
Corporal Key lay on his back, his fists clenched and his eyes shut fast. He did not answer. The Grand Inquisitor tilted his head ever so slightly to the left, and Father Farrell waved two fingers over one of the console icons. The icons were as abstract as hieroglyphics to the untutored eye, but Farrell knew them well. The one he had chosen would have translated as crushed testicles. On the gurney, Corporal Key gasped and opened his mouth to scream, but the neural inhibitors blocked that reaction. The short man's jaws opened as wide as they could, and Father Farrell could hear the muscles and tendons stretching. The Grand Inquisitor nodded, and Farrell removed his fingers from the activation zone above the icon. Corporal Key's entire body convulsed on the gurney, his stomach muscles rippling in tension.
"It's only virtual pain, Corporal Key," whispered the Grand Inquisitor. "A neural illusion. Your body is not marked."
On the slab, Key was straining to raise his head to look down at his body, but the stick-tight band held his head in place.
"Or perhaps not," continued the Cardinal. "Perhaps this time we have resorted to older, less refined methods."
He took a step closer to the gurney so that the man could see his face.
"Again, why did you and Father Captain de Soya let the girl go on God's Grove? Why did you attack your crewmate, Radamanth Nemes?"
Corporal Key's mouth worked until his back teeth became visible.
"Fuck you,"
he managed, his jaws tight against the shaking that was racking him.
"Of course," said the Grand Inquisitor, and nodded to Father Farrell.
This time the icon Farrell activated could be translated as "hot wire behind the right eye." Corporal Key opened his mouth in a silent scream.
"Again," said the Grand Inquisitor softly. "Tell us."
"Excuse me, Your Eminence," said Father Farrell, glancing at his comm log. "But the conclave mass begins in 45 minutes.
The Grand Inquisitor waved his fingers.
"We have time, Martin, we have time."
He touched Corporal Key's upper arm.
"Tell us these few facts, Corporal, and you will be bathed, dressed, and released. You have sinned against your church and your lord by this betrayal, but the essence of the church is forgiveness. Explain your betrayal, and all will be forgiven."
Amazingly, muscles still rippling with shock, Corporal Key laughed.
"Fuck you," he said. "You've already made me tell you everything I know under truth-tell. You know why we killed that bitch thing and let the child go, and you'll never let me go. Fuck you."
The Grand Inquisitor shrugged and stepped back. Glancing at his own gold comm log, he said softly,
"We have time. Much time."
He nodded to Father Farrell. The icon that looked like a double parenthesis on the virtual pain console stood for "broad and heated blade down esophagus." With a graceful motion of his eyes, Father Farrell activated it. Father Captain Federico de Soya was returned to life on Pochum, and had spent 2 weeks as a de facto prisoner in the Vatican Rectory of the Legionaries of Christ. The refectory was comfortable and tranquil. The plump little resurrection chaplain who attended to his needs, Father Baggio, was as kindly and solicitous as ever. De Soya hated the place and the priest. No one told Father Captain de Soya that he could not leave the Legionary's rectory, but he was made to understand that he should stay there until called. After a week of gaining strength and orientation after his resurrection, he was called to Pax Fleet headquarters, where he met with Admiral Wu and her boss, Admiral Maryusin. Father Captain de Soya did little during the meeting except salute, stand at ease, and listen. Admiral Maryusin explained that a review of the Father Captain de Soya's court-martial of 4 years earlier had shown several irregularities and inconsistencies in the prosecution's case. Further review of the situation had warranted a reversal of the court-martial board's decision. Father Captain de Soya was to be reinstated immediately at his former rank of captain in Pax Fleet. Arrangements were being made to find him a ship for combat duty.
"Your old torchship, the Balthazar, is in dry dock for a year," said Admiral Maryusin. "A complete refitting, being brought up to Archangel Escort standards. Your replacement, Mother Captain Stone, did an excellent job as skipper."
"Yes, sir," said de Soya. "Stone was an excellent exec. I'm sure she's been a good boss."
Admiral Maryusin nodded absently as he thumbed through vellum sheets in his notebook.
Yes, he said. So good, in fact, that we've recommended her as skipper for one of the new planet-class archangels. We have an archangel in mind for you as well, Father Captain.
DeSoya blinked and tried not to react. The Raphael, sir? The Admiral looked up, his tanned and creased face set in a slight smile.
Yes, the Raphael, but not the one you skippered before. We've retired that prototype to courier duty and renamed her. The new Archangel Raphael is... Well, you've heard about the planet-class Archangels, Father Captain?
No, sir, not really. He had heard rumors on his desert world when bauxite miners had talked loudly in the one cantina in town.
4 standard years, muttered the Admiral, shaking his head. His white hair was combed back behind his ears. Bring Federico up to speed here, Admiral.
Margit Wu nodded and touched the disk key on a standard tactical console set into Admiral Marjussen's wall. A hollow of a starship came into existence between her and DeSoya. The Father Captain could see at once that this ship was larger, sleeker, more refined, and deadlier than his old Raphael. His Holiness has asked each industrial world in the Pax to build, or at least to bankroll, one of these planet-class Archangel battlecruisers, Father Captain, said Admiral Wu in her briefing voice. In the past 4 years, 21 of them have been completed and have entered active service. Another 60 are nearing completion. The hollow began to rotate and enlarge until suddenly the main deck was shown in cutaway. It was as if a laser lance had sliced the ship in half. As you see, continued Wu, the living areas, common decks, and C-3 tactical centers are much roomier than on the earlier Raphael, roomier even than your old torchship. The drives, both the classified C-plus instantaneous Gideon drive and the in-system fusion plant, have been reduced in size by 1/3 while gaining in efficiency and ease of maintenance. The new Raphael carries 3 atmospheric dropships and a high-speed scout. There are automated resurrection creches aboard to serve a crew of 28 and up to 22 marines or passengers. Defenses? Asked Father Captain DeSoya, still standing at ease, his hands clasped behind him. Class 10 containment fields, said Wu crisply. The newest stealth technology, Omega-class ECM and jamming ability, as well as the usual assortment of close-in hyperkinetic and energy defenses. Attack capabilities? Said DeSoya. He could tell from the apertures and arrays visible on the hollow, but he wanted to hear it. Admiral Marjussen answered with a tone of pride, as if showing off a new grandchild.
The whole 9 meters, he said. CPBs, of course, but feeding off the C-plus drive core rather than the fusion drive. Slag anything within half an AU. New Hawking hyperkinetic missiles, miniaturized, about half the mass and size of the ones you carried on Balthazar. Plasma needles with almost twice the yield of the warheads of 5 years ago. Death beams.
Father Captain DeSoya tried not to react. Death beams had been prohibited in Pax Fleet. Marjussen saw something in the other man's face.
Things have changed, Federico. This fight is to the finish. The ousters are breeding like fruit flies out there in the dark, and unless we stop them, they'll be slagging Pacham in a year or two.
Father Captain DeSoya nodded. Do you mind if I ask which world paid for the building of this new Raphael, sir? Marjussen smiled and gestured toward the hollow. The hull of the ship seemed to hurtle toward DeSoya as the magnification increased. The view cut through the hull and closed on the tactical bridge, moving to the edge of the tactical center hollow pit, until the Father Captain could make out a small bronze plaque with the name HHS Raphael, and beneath that in smaller script, built and commissioned by the people of Heaven's Gate for the defense of all humanity.
Why are you smiling, Father Captain? Asked Admiral Marjussen.
Well, sir, it's just... Well, I've been to the world of Heaven's Gate, sir. It was, of course, more than 4 standard years ago, but the planet was empty, except for a dozen or so prospectors and a Pax garrison in orbit. There's been no real population there since the Ouster invasion 300 years ago, sir. I just couldn't imagine that world financing one of these ships.
It seems to me that it would take a planetary GNP of a society like Renaissance Vectors to pay for a single Archangel. Mariusen's smile had not faltered.
Precisely, Father Captain. Heaven's Gate is a hellhole. Poison atmosphere, acid rain, endless mud and sulfur flats. It's never recovered from the ouster attack. But His Holiness thought that the Pax's stewardship of that world might be better transferred to private enterprise. The planet still holds a fortune in heavy metals and chemicals. So we have sold it.
This time DeSoya blinked. Sold it, sir? An entire world? While Mariusen openly grinned, Admiral Wu said, To the Opus Dei, Father Captain. DeSoya did not speak, but neither did he show comprehension. The Work of God used to be a minor religious organization, said Wu. It's, I believe, about 1,200 years old, founded in 1920 A.D. In the past few years, it has become not only a great ally of the Holy See, but a worthy competitor of the Pax Mercantilis. Ah, yes, said Father Captain DeSoya. He could imagine the Mercantilis buying up entire worlds, but he could not imagine the trading group allowing a rival to gain such power in the few years he had been out of Pax news. It did not matter. He turned to Admiral Mariusen. One last question, sir. The Admiral glanced at his comlog chronometer and nodded curtly. I have been out of fleet service for 4 years, DeSoya said softly. I have not worn a uniform or received a tech update in all that time. The world where I served as a priest was so far out of the mainstream that I might as well have been in cryogenic fugue the whole time. How could I possibly take command of a new generation Archangel-class starship, sir? Mariusen frowned.
We'll bring you up to speed, Father Captain. Pax Fleet knows what it's doing. Are you saying no to this commission?
Father Captain DeSoya hesitated a visible second. No, sir, he said. I appreciate the confidence in me that you and Pax Fleet are showing. I'll do my best, Admiral. DeSoya had been trained to discipline twice, once as a priest and Jesuit, again as an officer in His Holiness's fleet. Mariusen's stone face softened.
Of course you will, Federico. We're pleased to have you back. We'd like you to stay at the Legionary's rectory here on Pacem until we're ready to send you to your ship, if that would be all right.
Damn it, thought DeSoya. Still a prisoner with those damned Legionaries. He said, Of course, sir, it's a pleasant place. Mariusen glanced at his comlog again. The interview was obviously at an end.
Any requests before the assignment becomes official, Father Captain?
DeSoya hesitated again. He knew that making a request would be bad form. He spoke anyway. Yes, sir, one. There were 3 men who served with me on the old Raphael, Swiss Guard commandos whom I brought from Hyperion. Lancer Reddick, well, he died, sir. But Sergeant Gregorius and Corporal Key were with me until the end, and I wondered— Mariusen nodded impatiently.
You want them on new Raphael with you? It sounds reasonable. I used to have a cook that I dragged from ship to ship. Poor bugger was killed during the second coal sack engagement. I don't know about these men.
The Admiral looked at Margit Wu. By great coincidence, said Admiral Wu, I ran across their files while reviewing your reinstatement papers, Father Captain. Sergeant Gregorius is currently serving in the Ring territories. I am sure that a transfer can be arranged. Corporal Key, I am afraid. DeSoya's stomach muscles tightened. Key had been with him around God's Grove. Gregorius had been returned to the creche after an unsuccessful resurrection, and the last he had seen of the lively little corporal had been after their return to Pacem space, when the MPs had taken them away to separate holding cells after their arrest. DeSoya had shaken the corporal's hand and assured him that they would see each other again. I am afraid that Corporal Key died 2 standard years ago, finished Wu. He was killed during an ouster attack on the Sagittarius salient. I understand that he received the Silver Star of St. Michael's. Posthumously, of course. DeSoya nodded tersely. Thank you, he said.
Admiral Maryusin gave his paternal politician smile and extended his hand across the desk to DeSoya.
Good luck, Federico. Give them hell from the Raphael.
The headquarters for the Pax Mercantilis was not on Pacem proper, but was located, fittingly, on the L5 Trojan point trailing behind the planet by some 60 orbital degrees. Between the Vatican world and the huge, hollow Taurus Mercantilis, a carbon-carbon donut 270 meters thick, a full click wide, and 26 kilometers in diameter, its interior webbed with spidery dry docks, comm antennae, and loading bays, floated half of Pax Fleet's total orbital-based firepower. Kenzo Isozaki once calculated that a coup attempt launched from Taurus Mercantilis would last 12.06 nanoseconds before being vaporized. Isozaki's office was in a clear bulb on a whiskered carbon flower stem, raised some 400 meters above the outer rim of the Taurus. The bulb's curved hull skin could be opaqued or left transparent, according to the whim of the CEO inside it. Today it was transparent, except for the section polarized to dim the glare of Pacem's yellow sun. Space seemed black at the moment, but as the Taurus rotated, the bulb would come into the ring's shadow, and Isozaki could glance up to see stars instantly appear, as if a heavy black curtain had been pulled aside to reveal thousands of brilliant, unflickering candles. Or the myriad campfires of my enemies, thought Isozaki, as the darkness fell for the 20th time on this working day. With the walls absolutely transparent, his oval office with its modest desk, chairs, and soft lamps seemed to become a carpeted platform, standing alone in the immensity of space, individual stars blazing and the long swath of the Milky Way lighting the interior. But it was not this familiar spectacle that made the Mercantilis CEO look up. Set amid the star field, three fusion tails of incoming freighters could be picked out, looking like smudges on an astronomical hollow. Isozaki was so adept at gauging distances and delta Vs from fusion tails that he could tell at a glance how long it would be before these freighters docked, and even which ships they were. The PM Moldahar Effectuator had refueled by skimming a gas giant in the Epsilon Eridani system and was burning redder than usual. The HHMS Emma Constance Skipper was in her usual rush to get her cargo of Pegasus 51 reaction metals to the Taurus and was decelerating inbound a good 15% above Mercantilis recommendations. Finally, the smallest smudge could only be the HHMS Eleemosyneria Apostolica, just passing spin down from its C-plus translation point from Renaissance System. Isozaki knew this from a glance, just as he knew the 300-some other optimal translation points visible in his part of the Pacem System sky. The lift tube rose from the floor and became a transparent cylinder, its passenger lit by starlight. Isozaki knew that the cylinder was transparent only from the outside. In it, the occupants stood in a mirrored interior, seeing nothing of the CEO's office, staring at their own reflection, until Isozaki keyed their door open. Anna Pelli Cognani was the only person in the tube. Isozaki nodded, and his personal AI rotated the cube door open. His fellow CEO and protege did not even glance up at the moving star field as she crossed the carpet toward him.
Good afternoon, Kenzo-san.
Good afternoon, Anna. He waved her toward the most comfortable chair, but Cognani shook her head and remained standing. She never took a seat in Isozaki's office. Isozaki never ceased offering her one.
The conclave mass is almost over, said Cognani.
Isozaki nodded. At that second, his office AI darkened the bubble walls and projected the Vatican's tight-beam broadcast. St. Peter's Basilica was awash in scarlet and purple and black and white this morning, as the 83 cardinals, soon to be sealed in the conclave, bowed, prayed, genuflected, knelt, stood, and sang. Behind this terna, or herd of theoretically possible candidates for the papacy, were the hundreds of bishops and archbishops, deacons and members of the curia, Pax military officials and Pax civil administrators, Pax planetary governors and high elected officials who happened to be on Pacem at the time of the Pope's death, or who were within 3 weeks' time debt, delegates from the Dominicans, the Jesuits, the Benedictines, the Legionaries of Christ, the Mariaists, the Salesians, and a single delegate standing for the few remaining Franciscans. Finally, there were the valued guests in the back rows, honorary delegates from the Pax Mercantilis, the Opus Dei, the Instituto per Opere di Religione, also known as the Vatican Bank, delegates from the Vatican administrative wings of the Prefettura, the Servizio Assistenziale del Santo Padre, the Holy Father's Welfare Service, from the APSA, the Administration of the Patrimony of the Holy See, as well as from Cardinal Camerlengo's own apostolic chamber. Also in the rear pews were honored guests from the Pontifical Academy of Sciences, the Papal Commission on Interstellar Peace and Justice, many papal academies, such as the Pontifical Ecclesiastical Academy, and other quasi-theological organizations necessary to the running of the vast Pax state. Finally, there were the bright uniforms of the Corps Helvetica, the Swiss Guard, as well as commanders of the Palatine Guard, reconstituted by Pope Julius, and the first appearance of the commander of the hitherto secret Noble Guard, a pale, dark-haired man in a solid red uniform. Isozaki and Cognani watched this pageant with knowledgeable eyes. Each of them had been invited to the Mass, but it had become a tradition in recent centuries for the Pax Mercantilis CEOs to honor major church ceremonies by their absence, sending only their official Vatican delegates. Both watched Cardinal Quesnongle celebrate this Mass of the Holy Spirit, and saw Cardinal Camerlengo as the powerless figurehead he was. Their eyes were on Cardinal Lourdesami, Cardinal Mustafa, and half a dozen other power brokers in the front pews. With the final benediction, the Mass ended, and the voting cardinals filed out in solemn procession to the Sistine Chapel, where the holocams lingered while the doors were sealed. The entrance to the conclave was closed, and that door bolted on the inside and padlocked on the outside, and the sealing of the conclave pronounced official by the commandant of the Swiss Guards and the prefect of the pontifical household. The Vatican coverage then shifted to commentary and speculation, while the image remained of the sealed door. "Enough," said Kenzo Isozaki. The broadcast flashed off. The bubble grew transparent, and sunlight flooded the room under a black sky. Anna Pelli Cognani smiled thinly.
"The voting shouldn't take too long."
Isozaki had returned to his chair. Now he steepled his fingers and tapped his lower lip. "Anna," he said, "do you think that we, all of us in the chairmanship of the Mercantilis, have any real power?" Cognani's neutral expression showed her surprise. She said,
"During the last fiscal year, Kenzo-san, my division showed a profit of 36 billion marks."
Isozaki held his steepled fingers still. "M. Cognani," he said, "would you be so kind as to remove your jacket and shirt?" His protege did not blink. In the 28 standard years they had been colleagues, subordinate and master, actually, M. Isozaki had never done, said, or implied anything that might have been interpreted as a sexual overture. She hesitated only a second, then unsealed her jacket, slipped it off, set it on the chair she never sat in, and unsealed her shirt. She folded it atop her jacket on the back of the chair. Isozaki rose and came around his desk, standing only a meter from her. "You're under things as well," he said, slipping off his own jacket and unbuttoning his own old-fashioned shirt. His chest was healthy, muscled, but hairless. Cognani slipped off her chemise. Her breasts were small but perfectly formed, rosy at the tips. Kenzo Isosaki lifted one hand as if he were going to touch her, pointed, and then returned the hand to his own chest and touched the double-barred cruciform that ran from his sternum to just above his navel.
"This," he said, "is power."
He turned away and began dressing. After a moment, Anna Pelli Cognani hugged her shoulders and then also began dressing. When they were both dressed, Isozaki sat behind his desk again and gestured toward the other chair. To his quiet astonishment, M. Anna Pelli Cognani sat in it.
"What you are saying," began Cognani, "is that no matter how successful we are in making ourselves indispensable to the new pope, if there ever is a new pope, the church will always have the ultimate leverage of resurrection."
"Not quite," said Isozaki,
steepling his fingers again as if the previous interlude had not happened.
"I am saying that the power controlling the cruciform controls the human universe."
"The church," began Cognani and stopped. "Of course, the cruciform is just part of the power equation. The Technocorps provides the church with the secret of successful resurrection, but they've been in league with the church for 280 years.
"For their own purposes," said Isozaki softly. "What are those purposes, Anna?"
The office rotated into night. Stars exploded into existence. Cognani raised her face to the Milky Way to gain a moment to think.
"No one knows," she said at last. "Ohm's Law."
Isozaki smiled.
"Very good. Following the path of least resistance here may not lead us through the church, but via the core."
"But Counselor Albedo meets with no one except His Holiness and Lord Usami."
"No one that we know of," amended Isozaki. "But that is a matter of the core coming to the human universe."
Cognani nodded. She understood the implicit suggestion. The illicit core-class AIs that the Mercantilis was developing could find the datum plane avenue and follow it to the core. For almost 300 years, the prime commandment enforced by the Church and Pax had been, "Thou shalt not build a thinking machine equal or superior to humankind." AIs in use within the Pax were more all-purpose instruments than artificial intelligences of the kind that had evolved away from humanity almost a millennium earlier. Idiot thinking machines like Isosaki's office AI or the cretinish ship computer under Soya's old ship, the Raphael. But in the past dozen years, secret research departments of the Pax Mercantilis had recreated the autonomous AIs equal to or surpassing those in common use during the days of the hegemony. The risk and benefits of this project were almost beyond measure. Absolute domination of Pax trade and a breaking of the old balance of power standoff between Pax fleet and Pax Mercantilis, if successful. Excommunication, torture in the dungeons of the Holy Office, and execution, if discovered by the Church. And now this prospect. Anna Pelli Cognani stood.
"My God," she said softly, "that would be the ultimate end run."
Isozaki nodded and smiled again.
"Do you know where that term originated, Anna?"
"End run? No. Some sport, I imagine."
"A very ancient warfare surrogate sport called football," said Isozaki.
Cognani knew that this irrelevancy was anything but irrelevant. Sooner or later, her master would explain why this datum was important. She waited.
"The church had something that the Corps wanted, needed," said Isozaki. "The taming of the cruciform was their part of the deal. The church had to barter something of equal worth."
Cognani thought, "Equal in worth to the immortality of a trillion human beings?" She said,
"I had always assumed that when Lennar Hoyt and Lord Usami contacted the surviving core elements more than 2 centuries ago, that the church's bartering point was in secretly re-establishing the Technocore in human space."
Isozaki opened his hands.
"To what ends, Anna?
Where is the benefit to the core?
When the core was an integral part of the hegemony, she said. Running the world web and the fat line, they were using the neurons in the billions of human brains transiting the Farcasters as a sort of neural net, part of their ultimate intelligence project.
Ah, yes, said her mentor. But there are no Farcasters now. If they are using human beings, how and where?
Without meaning to, Anna Pelli Cognani raised one hand to her breastbone.
Isozaki smiled. Irritating, isn't it? Like a word that is on the tip of one's tongue but will not come to mind. A puzzle with a missing piece. But there is one piece that was missing, which has just been found.
Cognani raised an eyebrow. The girl?
Back in Pack Space, said the older CEO. Our agents close to Lord Asami have confirmed that the Corps has revealed this. It happened after the death of His Holiness. Only the Secretary of State, the Grand Inquisitor, and the top people in Pack's fleet know.
Where is she?
Isozaki shook his head. If the Corps knows, they haven't revealed it to the Church or any other human agency. But Pack's fleet has called up that ship's captain, DeSoya, because of the news.
The Corps had predicted that he would be involved in the girl's capture, said Cognani. The beginnings of a smile were working at the corners of her mouth.
Yes, said Isozaki, proud of his student.
Ohm's Law, said Cognani.
Precisely.
The woman stood and again touched her chest without being aware of doing so. If we find the girl first, we have the leverage to open discussions with the Corps, and the means, with the new abilities we will have online.
None of the CEOs who knew of the secret AI project ever said the words or phrases aloud, despite their bug-proof offices.
If we have the girl and the means of negotiating, continued Cognani, we may have the leverage we need to supplant the Church in the Corps' arrangement with humanity.
If we can discover what the Corps is getting from the Church in return for control of the cruciform, murmured Isozaki, and offer the same or better.
Cognani nodded in a distracted manner. She was seeing how all of this related to her goals and efforts as CEO of Opus Dei. In every way, she realized at once. In the meantime, we have to find the girl before the others do. Pack's fleet must be utilizing resources they would never reveal to the Vatican.
And vice versa, said Isozaki.
This kind of contest pleased him very much. And we will have to do the same, said Cognani, turning toward the lift tube. Every resource.
She smiled at her mentor.
It's the ultimate three-way, zero-sum game, isn't it, Kenzo-san?
Just so, said Isozaki. Everything to the winner. Power, immortality, and wealth beyond human imagining. To the loser? Destruction, the true death, and eternal slavery for one's descendants.
He held up one finger.
But not a three-way game, Anna. Six.
Cognani paused by the lift door. I see the fourth, she said. The Corps has its own imperative to find the girl first, but...
Isozaki lowered his hand. We must presume that the child has her own goals in this game, mustn't we? And whoever or whatever has introduced her as a playing piece, well, that must be our sixth player.
Or one of the other five, said Cognani, smiling. She also enjoyed a high-stakes game.
Isozaki nodded and turned his chair to watch the next sunrise above the curving-away band of the Taurus Mercantilis. He did not turn back when the lift door closed and Anna Pelli Cognani departed.
Above the altar, Jesus Christ, his face stern and unrelenting, divided men into camps of the good and the bad, the rewarded and the damned. There was no third group.
Cardinal Lourdes de Sami sat in his canopied stall inside the Sistine Chapel and looked at Michelangelo's fresco of the Last Judgment. Lourdes de Sami had always thought that this Christ was a bullying, authoritarian, merciless figure, perhaps an icon perfectly suited to oversee this choice of a new vicar of Christ. The little chapel was crowded with the 83 canopied stalls seating the 83 cardinals present in the flesh. An empty space allowed for activation of the hollows representing the missing 37 cardinals, one hollow of a canopied stall at a time. This was the first morning after the cardinals had been nailed up in the Vatican Palace. Lourdes de Sami had slept and eaten well, his bedroom a cot in his Vatican office, his repast a simple meal cooked by the nuns of the Vatican guest house. Simple food and a cheap white wine served in the glorious Borgia apartments. Now all were gathered in the Sistine Chapel, their stall thrones in place, their canopies raised. Lourdes de Sami knew that this splendid sight had been missing from the conclave for many centuries, ever since the number of cardinals had grown too large to accommodate the stalls in the small chapel, sometime pre-Hegira, the 19th or 20th century A.D., he thought. But the church had grown so small by the end of the fall of the Farcasters that the 40-some cardinals could once again easily fit. Pope Julius had kept the number small, never more than 120 cardinals, despite the growth of the Pax. And with almost 40 of them unable to travel in time to the conclave, the Sistine Chapel could hold the stalls of those cardinals permanently based on Pacem. The moment had come. All of the cardinal electors in the chapel stood as one. In the empty space near the scrutineer's table near the altar, the hollows of the 37 absent cardinal electors shimmered into existence. Because the space was small, the hollows were small. Little more than doll-sized human figures in doll-sized wooden stalls, all of them floating in midair, like ghosts of conclave electors past. Lourdes de Sami smiled, as he always did, at how appropriate the reduced size of these absent electors seemed. Pope Julius had always been elected by acclamation. One of the three cardinals acting as scrutineers raised his hand. The Holy Spirit may have been prepared to move these men and women, but some coordination was required. When the scrutineer's hand dropped, the 83 cardinals in 37 hollows were to speak as one.
"Eligo Father Lenar Hoyt," cried Cardinal Lourdes de Sami,
and saw Cardinal Mustafa shouting the same words from beneath the canopy of his stall. The scrutineer in front of the altar paused. The acclamation had been loud and clear, but obviously not unanimous. This was a new wrinkle. For 270 years, the acclamation had been immediate. Lourdes de Sami was careful not to smile or look around. He knew which of the newer cardinals had not cried out Pope Julius's name for re-election. He knew the wealth it had taken to bribe these men and women. He knew the terrible risk they were running and would almost certainly suffer for. Lourdes de Sami knew all this because he had helped to orchestrate it. After a moment of consultation among the scrutineers, the one who had called for acclamation now said,
"We shall proceed by scrutiny."
There was excited talk among the cardinals as the ballots were prepared and handed out. This had never happened before in the lifetime of most of these princes of the church. Immediately, the acclamation hollows of the missing cardinal electors had become irrelevant, although a few of the absent cardinals had prepared their interactive chips for scrutiny, most had not bothered. The master of ceremonies moved among the stalls, distributing voting cards, three to each cardinal elector. The scrutineers moved among the forest of stalls to make sure that each of the cardinals had a pen. When all was in readiness, the cardinal deacon among the scrutineers raised his hand again, this time to signify the moment of voting. Lourdes de Sami looked at his ballot. On the upper left, the words, "Eligo in summum pontificem," appeared in print. There was room for one name beneath it. Simon Augustino Cardinal Lourdes de Sami wrote in Lenar Hoyt and folded the card and held it up so that it could be seen. Within a minute, all 83 of the cardinals were holding a card aloft, as were half a dozen of the interactive hollows. The scrutineer began calling the cardinals forward in order of precedence. Cardinal Lourdesamy went first, leaving his stall and walking to the scrutineer's table next to the altar beneath the gaze of the terrible Christ of the fresco. Genuflecting and then kneeling at the altar, Lourdesamy bowed his head in silent prayer. Rising, he said aloud,
"I call to witness Christ the Lord, who will be my judge, that my vote is given to the one who before God I consider should be elected."
Lourdesamy solemnly set his folded card on the silver plate that sat atop the vote receptacle. Lifting the plate, he dropped his vote into the receptacle. The cardinal deacon among the scrutineers nodded. Lourdesamy bowed toward the altar and returned to his stall. Cardinal Mustafa, the Grand Inquisitor, moved majestically toward the altar to cast the second vote. It was more than an hour later that the votes were tallied. The first scrutineer shook the receptacle to mix the votes. The second scrutineer counted them, including the 6 votes copied from the interactive hollows, depositing each in a second receptacle. The count equaled the number of voting cardinals in the conclave. The scrutiny proceeded. The first scrutineer unfolded a card, wrote down the name on it, and passed the card to the second scrutineer, who made a note and passed it to the third and final scrutineer. This man, Cardinal Quesnongle, as it turned out, said the name aloud before making a note of it. In each of the stalls, a cardinal jotted the name on a scriber pad provided by the scrutineers. At the end of the conclave, the scribers would be scrambled, their files deleted so that no record of the voting would remain. And so the voting proceeded. For Lourdesamy, as for the rest of the living cardinals present, the only suspense was whether the dissident cardinal electors from the acclamation would actually put someone else's name into play. As each card was read, the last scrutineer ran a threaded needle through the word "Eligo" and slid the card down the thread. When all of the ballots had been read aloud, knots were tied in each end of the thread. The winning candidate was admitted to the chapel. Standing before the altar in a simple black cassock, the man looked humble and a bit overwhelmed. Standing before him, the senior deacon cardinal said,
"Do you accept your canonical election as supreme pontiff?"
"I do accept it," said the priest. At this point, a stall was brought out and set behind the priest. The cardinal deacon raised his hands and intoned,
"Thus accepting your canonical election, this gathering does, in the sight of God Almighty, acknowledge you as Bishop of the Church of Rome, true Pope, and head of the College of Bishops. May God advise you well as he grants you full and absolute power over the Church of Jesus Christ."
"Amen,"
said Cardinal Lourdesamy and pulled the cord that lowered the canopy over his stall. All 83 physical canopies and 37 holographic ones lowered at the same time, until only the new popes remained raised. The priest, now pontiff, sat back in the seat beneath the papal canopy.
"What name do you choose as supreme pontiff?" asked the deacon cardinal.
"I choose the name Urban the 16th, said the seated priest. There was a murmuring and hum from the cardinal's stalls. The cardinal deacon held out his hand, and he and the other scrutineers led the priest from the chapel. The murmuring and whispering rose in volume. Cardinal Mustafa leaned out of his stall and said to Lourdesamy,
"He must be thinking of Urban the 2nd. Urban the 15th was a sniveling little coward in the 29th century, who did little but read detective novels and write love letters to his former mistress."
"Urban the 2nd, mused Lourdesamy. "Yes, of course."
After several minutes, the scrutineers returned with the priest, now the Pope dressed in pure white, a white-caped Cossack, a white zucchetto or skull cap, a pectoral cross, and a white fascia sash. Cardinal Lourdesamy went to his knees on the stone floor of the chapel, as did all the other cardinals, real and holographic, as the new pontiff gave his first benediction. Then the scrutineers and the attending cardinals went to the stove to burn the votes, now tethered on black thread, adding enough bianco chemical to make sure that the sfumata would indeed be white smoke. The cardinals filed out of the Sistine Chapel and walked the ancient paths and corridors to St. Peter's, where the senior cardinal deacon went alone onto the balcony to announce the name of the new pontiff to the waiting multitudes. Among the 500,000 waiting individuals in the multitude squeezed into, out of, and around St. Peter's Square that morning was Father Captain Federico de Soia. He had been released from his de facto imprisonment at the Legionaries' Rectory only hours before. He was to report to Pax Fleet's spaceport later that afternoon for shuttle to his new command. Walking through the Vatican, de Soia had followed the crowds, then had been engulfed by them, as men, women, and children had flowed like a great river toward the square. A great cheer had gone up when the puffs of white smoke first became visible from the stovepipe. The impossibly thick throng beneath the balcony of St. Peter's somehow became thicker, as tens of thousands more flowed around the colonnades and past the statuary. Hundreds of Swiss Guard troopers held the crowd back from the entrance to the basilica and away from private areas. When the senior deacon emerged and announced that the new pope was to be called His Holiness Urban XVI, a great gasp went up from the crowd. De Soia found himself gaping in surprise and shock. Everyone had expected Julius XV. The thought of anyone else as pope was, well, unthinkable. Then the new pontiff stepped onto the balcony and the gasps turned to cheers that went on and on and on. It was Pope Julius, the familiar face, the high forehead, the sad eyes. Father Lenar Hoyt, the savior of the church, had once again been elected. His Holiness raised his hand in the familiar benediction and waited for the crowd to stop cheering so that he could speak, but the crowd would not stop cheering. The roar rose from 500,000 throats and went on and on. Why Urban XVI? Wondered Father Captain de Soia. He had read and studied enough history of the church in his years as a Jesuit. Quickly he thumbed back through his mental notes on the Urban popes. Most were forgettable or worse. Why? Damn! Father Captain de Soia said aloud, the soft curse lost under the continuing roar of the faithful filling St. Peter's Square. Damn, he said again. Even before the crowd quieted enough for the new old pontiff to speak, to explain his choice of names, to announce what de Soia knew had to be announced, the Father Captain understood. And his heart sank with that understanding. Urban II had served from A.D. 1088 to 1099, at the synod the Pope had called in Clermont in November in the year 1095, de Soia thought. Urban II had made his call for holy war against the Muslims in the Near East, for the rescue of Byzantium, and for the liberation of all Eastern Christian holy places from Muslim domination. That call had led to the First Crusade, the first of many bloody campaigns. The crowd finally quieted. Pope Urban XVI began to speak, the familiar but newly energized voice rising and falling over the heads of the 500,000 faithful listening in person and the billions listening via live broadcast. Father Captain de Soia turned away even before the new pope began to speak. He pushed and elbowed his way back through the unmoving crowd, trying to escape the suddenly claustrophobic confines of St. Peter's Square. It was no use. The crowd was rapt and joyous, and de Soia was trapped in the mob. The words from the new pontiff were also joyous and impassioned. Father Captain de Soia stood, unable to escape, and bowed his head. As the crowd began cheering and crying, Deus le vult! God wills it. De Soia began to weep. Crusade. Glory. a final resolution of the ouster problem. Death beyond imagining. Destruction beyond imagining. Father Captain DeSoya squeezed his eyes shut as tightly as he could, but the vision of charged particle beams flaring against the blackness of space, of entire worlds burning, of oceans turning to steam and continents into molten rivers of lava, visions of orbital forests exploding into smoke, of charred bodies tumbling in zero-G, of fragile, winged creatures flaring and charring and expanding into ash. DeSoya wept, while billions cheered.